There are certainly some occasions when an introduction of the conventional sort that I'm about to make are mere absurdities. Inasmuch as I'm about to introduce a lady who is almost certainly the most distinguished woman of letters living in the world today, and a woman who the quiet retirement of her personal life, to the contrary, has left an extraordinary impression of her personality on the world of literature, I feel in introducing her I'm simply wasting your time, and I will try to waste as little of it as possible simply by recalling a few of her achievements. I'd like to say it before that Miss Moore would like to read and comment on her poems tonight in two parts, so that after roughly half an hour she will pause for 10 minutes. If you leave the room, please come back promptly in 10 minutes, since we have no bell to call you or anything of that sort. Miss Moore was born in St. Louis just 1 year before T.S. Eliot was born in St. Louis, which seems quite extraordinary as one thinks about it. But she lived most of her life in Brooklyn, and I believe that she is now a saddened Dodgers enthusiast. After her graduation from Bryn Mawr, she taught commercial subjects in a school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania for 4 years. Then she was an assistant in the New York Public Library for 4 more years. After that, she was the editor for 4 years of that most distinguished American literary magazine, The Dial. She began publishing her verse in 1915, and in 1921, without her knowledge, her first book of poems was published through the office, shall I say, of friends. Her first book of poems, the management of which was in her control, the book called Observations, was published in 1924 and won the Dial Award. Then her volumes followed in quick succession. In 1935, Selected Poems. In 1936, The Pangolin and Other Verse. In 1941, What Are Years. In 1944, Nevertheless. 1951, Collected Poems. 1954, A Variation, her translation of the Fables of La Fontaine. 1955, a book called Predilections, her essays, and most recently in 1956, her book of verse, Like a Bulwark. Her letters have not been published, but we have all had a sample of what we may expect when they are from that epistolary colloquium in the New Yorker, which demonstrated not only her endless ingenuity, but also the fact that heavy industry is not yet ready to collaborate with poets. Her honors have, of course, been many. I will only name a few, though, since 1944. In that year, she won the Contemporary Poetry's Patrons Prize and the Harriet Monroe Poetry Award. In 1945, a Guggenheim Award. In 1946, the joint grant of $1,000 from the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the National Institute of Arts and Letters. In 1947, she was elected to membership in the National Institute of Arts and Letters. In 1951, she was awarded the Bullingen Prize. In 1952, the National Book Award in Poetry and the Pulitzer Prize. In 1953, the Gold Medal for Poetry of the National Institute of Arts and Letters. Her most recent accomplishment was just this evening, and this is why we are late. She has just acted as midwife to 3 kittens. I think that Miss Moore's poetry, and I'm not going to hold you up with this, since she will demonstrate it, is best described in a very happy phrase of Morton Don Zabel's. She is a literalist of the imagination. Her poetry, delicate and dazzling as it is also like a bulwark. is a bulwark against every threat from the uncivilized, the illiberal, and the inhumane. I have never had an honor so great as presenting Miss Marion Moore.
Friends, if I could match this introduction and the audience and the room, the auditorium, all would be well. I don't know. We shall see. Mr. Shore is right. I said just now, I can't leave these kittens. But it's a very noble experience to be here speaking to you, so interested in these things. As I hear this enumeration of medals, honors, grants, books, and so forth, I feel as if it were about somebody else. I would say this, that when I received the National Book Award, and I was asked what I would say about this, I said, well, I can say this. I'm called a poet because there's no other category in which to put me. That's true. You can't say no. I have some skeptics like this, whoever it was who really edited the Carnegie Foundation American Panorama, who said various things about me and said one would be at a loss to find a lyric passage in her entire work. I felt quite downcast, but I don't feel quite so with all you coming here, taking this trouble to hear these prosaic things. Now, I'm a little too sketchy about my readings, and I wish to read twice, and I have failed to do it, an early piece called The Chameleon, which Robert Duncan restored my confidence in. He said, why has this never been reprinted? And I thought, well, it has merit, perhaps, but I now discern why it has never been reprinted. The final words are, this emerald could not snap up the spectrum, the spectrum's food, as you have done. If I ended with food, I'd commend it, but as you have done, and it's a rhyme with one, so it has to stay there. Maybe somebody else can amend me. It goes as follows. A chameleon. Hid by the august foliage and fruit of the grapevine, twine your anatomy around the pruned and polished stem, chameleon. Fire laid upon an emerald as long as the dark king's massy one could not snap up the spectrum for food as you have done. Now, a face. This helped me out of a difficulty with horizon. Cyril Connolly asked if I would write something, and I spent several days trying to, for I like to read horizon, and I think the great reward in writing is to be with friends, with contributors whose work you like. And I couldn't succeed, and I had to discard it, and then this occurred to me, and it wasn't too long or too abstruse. I am not a face. I am not treacherous, callous, jealous, superstitious, supercilious, venomous, or absolutely hideous. Studying and studying its expression, exasperated desperation, though at no real impasse, would gladly break the glass. When love of order, ardor, uncircuitous simplicity are all one needs to be, certain faces, a few, one or two, or one face photographed by recollection, to my mind, to my sight, must remain a delight. Now, nine nectarines. I think, I don't know, this is very unprofessional. I can't remember why I was reading this. I think because Mr. Ballouf would be interested in it. Anyhow, this is it. I have not read this while I've been in California. Perhaps my fruit is outdone by what we already have. Mr. Winter's pineapple guavas and things of that kind. Nine nectarines. Arranged by twos, as peaches are, at intervals that all may live, eight and a single one, on twigs that grew the year before, they look like a derivative. Although not uncommonly the opposite is seen, nine peaches on a nectarine. Fuzzless through slender leaves of green or blue or both in the Chinese style, the four pairs, half-moon leaf mosaic turns out to the sun, the sprinkled blush of Pousse American Beauty pink applied to beeswax gray by the uninquiring brush of mercantile bookbinding. Remember, I had just received a new dictionary with one of those freckled, speckled edges, and I'm very grateful to it. Like the, I've been asked several times what that has to do with this. Like the red-cheeked peach, which cannot aid the dead, but eaten in time prevents death, the Italian peach nut, Persian plum, Isfahan, secluded wall-grown nectarine, as wild spontaneous fruit was found in China first. But was it wild? Prudent de Condor would not say. One perceives no flaws in this emblematic group, with leaf window unquilted by Curculio, which someone once depicted on this much mended plate, or in the also accurate unantlered moose or Iceland horse or ass asleep against the old thick low-leaning nectarine that is the color of the shrub tree's brownish flower. A Chinese understands the spirit of the wilderness, and the nectarine-loving unicorn of pony appearance, the long-tailed or the tailless, small, cinnamon-brown, common camel-haired unicorn, with antelope feet and no horn, here enameled in porcelain. It was a Chinese who imagined this masterpiece. We were suffering from fancy patterns at the time I wrote this, and I set in the last line of each stanza of green or blue or both in the Chinese style the four pairs. So or and four rhyme. And I put a space between them. I thought it was rather affected to do it any other way. And when I came to have this reprinted, I removed the spaces. Then I couldn't find the rhymes. It took me a long time. And it's a little super ingenious. Italian and Isfahan and accurate and mended plate and so on. So I see that I may help the reader a little bit there. But even so, it didn't help me not to be told that I don't write lyrics. Well, Yeats had a letter from a young man today, a Mr. Kennedy, who reminded me that Yeats said the purpose of rhythm is to delay the moment of contemplation. I think that's very nice. I'd forgotten it if I ever knew it. Now, when I buy pictures, yes, I will interrupt myself to say that Lincoln Kirstein very benevolently had a plaster head of mine by Lachaise cast in bronze on a marble block that turns around so you can see everything. And Knoedler's were exhibiting Lachaise, and Lincoln Kirstein brought this to their attention. And they said, they gave me a place in the catalog from Miss Marion Moore's collection. Well, it was just one. It's just that. Just starting. When I buy pictures, or what is closer to the truth, when I look at that of which I may regard myself as the imaginary possessor, I fix upon what would give me pleasure in my average moments. The satire upon curiosity, in which no more is discernible than the intensity of the mood, or quite the opposite, the old thing, the medieval decorated hat box, in which there are hounds with waists diminishing like the waist of the hourglass, and deer and birds and seated people. It may be no more than a square of parquetry, the literal biography, perhaps. I guess I meant a portrait. In letters standing well apart upon a parchment-like expanse, an artichoke in six varieties of blue, the snipe-legged hieroglyphic in three parts, the silver fence protecting Adam's grave, or Michael taking Adam by the wrist. Too stern an intellectual emphasis upon this quality or that detracts from one's enjoyment. It must not wish to disarm anything, nor be that which may too easily be honored. That which is great because something else is small. It comes to this, of whatever sort it is, it must be lit with piercing glances into the life of things. It must acknowledge the spiritual forces which have made it. Rigorous. This is about Dr. Sheldon Jackson, who introduced reindeer to Alaska. And it's striking indeed how we take as a matter of course something that really nearly cost a person life. The congressional record is not electrifying reading. You don't rush back to see what it says next. But I almost did in reading this, because the drama of it, Dr. Jackson pleading with these papier-mâché executives who could not see a reason. Finally he said, it has seven or eight, I forget how many uses. The skin makes tents, the bones make fuel, the animal makes meat, it's a beast of burden, and went on still. They didn't see any reason why anyone would want reindeer. Rigorous. We saw reindeer browsing. A friend who'd been in Lapland said, finding their own food, they are adapted to scant merino or pasture, yet they can run 11 miles in 50 minutes. The feet spread when the snow is soft and act as snowshoes. They are rigorists. However handsomely cutwork artists of Lapland and Siberia elaborate the trace or saddle girth with sawtooth leather lace, one looked at this, one looked at us, with its firm face, part brown, part white, a queen of alpine flowers. Santa Claus reindeer, seen at last, had gray-brown fur with a neck like edelweiss or lion's foot, Leontopodium more exactly, and this candelabra-headed ornament for a place where ornaments are scarce, sent to Alaska, was a gift preventing the extinction of the Eskimo. The battle was won by a quiet man, Sheldon Jackson, evangel to that race whose reprieve he read in the reindeer's face. Now, a carriage from Sweden. If any of these seem a little beside the point, I've been requested to read them. I wonder if public speakers, different places, aid themselves in this way. I've been requested to read this, but but it's really true, right, in this case. If it's a whim, it's a rather extensive one. This is based on a true story. I went to the Brooklyn Museum long ago and saw this beautifully made thing, this cart from Sweden. And then I went back in 5 or 10 years and it was no longer there. It's under a cloth somewhere. And I was very disappointed indeed. And I persevered and made a great to-do about it and how unjust this was, and I did get to see it again. They say there is a sweeter air where it was made than we have here, a Hamlet's castle atmosphere. At all events, there is in Brooklyn something that makes me feel at home. No one may see this put-away museum piece, this country cart that inner happiness made art. And yet, in this city of freckled integrity, not this one, but mine, a resin straightness from north wind hardened Sweden's once supposed to compromise archipelago of rocks, Washington and Gustavus Adolphus forgive our decay. Seats, dashboard, and sides of smooth gourd-rind texture, a flowered step, a swan dart break, and swirling crustacean-tailed equine amphibious creatures that garnish the axle tree. What a fine thing. What unannoying romance. And how beautiful she, with the natural stoop of the snowy aigrette, gray-eyed and straight-haired, for whom it should come to the door, of whom it reminds me. The split pine fair hair, steady, gallant clear eyes, and the pine needle path, dear swift step, that is Sweden, land of the free and the soil for a spruce tree, vertical, though a seedling, all needles, from a green trunk, green shelf on shelf, fanning out by itself. Sweden, you have a runner called the deer, who when he's won a race likes to run more. You have the sunlight gable, due east and west. The table spread is for a banquet, and the put-in twin vests, vest pleats with a fish fin effect when you need none. Sweden, what makes the people dress that way? I understand. It's not pine needle paths that have spring when they're run on. It's a Sweden of moated white castles, the bed of white flowers, densely grown in an S, meaning Sweden and stalwartness, skill, and the surface that says, made in Sweden, carts are my trade. Now, propriety. In some such word as the chord bronze, heard from a bird, sung it down near the root of the throat, it's the little downy woodpecker spiraling up a tree, up, 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 like mercury. A not long sparrow song of hayseed magnitude, attuned reticence with rigor from strength at the source. Propriety is box, solfeggetto, harmonica and basso. The fish spine on firs, on somber trees, by the sea's walls of wave-worn rock, have it, and a moon bow, and Bach's cheerful firmness in a minor key. It's an owl and a pussy, both content, agreement. Come, come, it's mixed with wits. It's not a graceful sadness. It's resistance with bent head, like foxtail millet. Bronze and Bach? No. Bach and Brahms. To thank Bach for his song first is wrong. Pardon me, both are unintentional pansy face, uncursed by self-inspection, blackened because born that way. I found all kinds of fault with this for comparing Brahms with Bach. Well, at the time, Daniel Gregory Mason had been expounding Bach in the Brooklyn Academy, and I couldn't think of anything else at the time. But that perhaps doesn't extenuate this hasty connecting of the two. Armors undermining modesty. Now, to my desperation, I heard that a class at the YMHA, Young Men's Hebrew Association, had spent a whole hour discussing what I meant by this. And then I have a neighbor, you may know him out here, Royal Murdoch. He cuts fur in one season and writes verse in another. And he's written some very interesting things. Well, he asked me if I would explain it. And it seemed to me that always to the person who writes the thing as if it's pretty flat to explain what is self-evident. But I made an attempt anyhow. Armors undermining modesty. At first, I thought a pest must have alighted on my wrist. It was a moth, almost an owl. Its wings were furred so well, with backgammon board wedges interlacing on the wing. Like cloth of gold in a pattern of scales with a hair-sheen Persian tint. Once, self-determination made an axe of stone and hacked things out with hairy paws. The consequence? Our misset alphabet. Arise, for it is day. Even gifted scholars lose their way through faulty etymology. No wonder we hate poetry and stars and harps and the new moon. I think I'll have to interrupt this. It amuses me so. Last summer, a very unamusing task turned up one line in a great heavy contest that took me 4 days to read, and it was this, in a piece called Solitude, "The cloister doth make cobwebs of us all." Now, I'll continue. This is mine. I'm not as witty as that. If tributes cannot be implicit, give me diatribes and the fragrance of iodine, the cork oak acorn grown in Spain, the pale ale-eyed impersonal look of which the sales placard gives the bock beer buck. What is more precise than illusion? What is more precise than precision? Illusion. Knights we've known, like those familiar, now unfamiliar knights who sought the grail, were dukes in old Roman fashion, without the addition of wreaths and silver rods and armor gilded or inlaid. They did not let self bar their usefulness to others who were different. They did not let self bar their usefulness to others who were different. That has a very unemphasized bearing, I think, on our troubles there in Little Rock and some other places. Though Mars is excessive in being preventive, heroes need not write an ordinal of attributes to enumerate what they hate. I should, I confess, like to have a talk with one of them about excess and armors undermining modesty instead of innocent depravity. A mirror of steel uninsistence should countenance continence, objectified and not by chance, there in its frame of circumstance, of innocence and altitude in an unhackneyed solitude. There is the tarnish, and there the imperishable wish. Now, should we have an intermission? I'm sorry to hear that you can't all get these words as I read them. Now, if you can't hear now, and if the guests in the front row will bear with my stentorian bellowing, well, I think you'll put up with that. It doesn't seem very polite. Is this I? I'll try to do better, and I shall not move around. I must say you have unbounded fortitude. Stand there. I don't feel inclined to exhibit this piece in distrust of merits, but Mr. Shore says yes, and contributed to Origen a long time ago, said to me, it isn't a poem. No poem, but it's sincere. And for that reason. And I said, that's exactly what I say myself. And I can't make it flashing and wonderful. This is the way it is. In distrust of merits, strengthened to live, strengthened to die, for medals and positioned victories, they're fighting, fighting, fighting. The blind man who thinks he sees, who cannot see that the enslaver is enslaved, the hater harmed. O shining, O firm star, O tumultuous ocean lashed till the small things go as they will. The mountainous wave makes us who look no depth. Lost at sea before they fought. O star of David, star of Bethlehem, O black imperial lion of the Lord, emblem of a risen world, be joined at last, be joined. There is hate's crown, without which none is king. The blessed deeds bless the halo, as contagion of sickness makes sickness, contagion of trust can make trust. They're fighting in deserts and caves, one by one, in battalions and squadrons. They are fighting that I may yet recover from the disease myself. Can you hear this better? Some have it lightly, some will die. Man is wolf to man, and we devour ourselves. The enemy could not have made a greater breach in our defenses. One piloting a blind man can escape him, but Job, disheartened by false comfort, knew that nothing can be so defeating as a man who cannot see, as a blind man who can see. I got that wrong. Oh, alive who are dead, who are proud not to see. Oh, small dust of the earth that walks so arrogantly. Trust begets power, and faith is an affectionate thing. We vow, we make this promise to the fighting, it's a promise. We'll never hate black, white, red, yellow, Jew, Gentile, untouchable. We are not competent to make our vows. With set jaw, they are fighting, fighting, fighting. Some we love whom we know, and some we love and know not. That hearts may feel and not be numb. It cures me, or am I what I can't believe in? Some in snow, some in crags, some in quicksands. Little by little, much by much, they are fighting, 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 that where there was death, there may be life. When a man is prey to anger, he is moved by outside things. When he holds his ground in patience, 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 that is action or beauty, the soldier's defense and hardest armor for the fight. The world's an orphan's home. Shall we never have peace without sorrow, without pleas of the dying for help that won't come? O quiet form upon the dust, I cannot look, and yet I must. If these great patient dyings, all these agonies and wound bearings and bloodshed can teach us how to live, these dyings were not wasted. Hate hardened heart, O heart of iron. Iron is iron till it is rust. I must fight till I have conquered in myself what causes war, but I would not believe it. I inwardly did nothing. O Iscariot-like crime, beauty is everlasting and dust is for a time. Now I'm going to read the thank you. The Labors of Hercules. Well, there are many of these labors of Hercules. Excessive, I'm not beginning at the beginning, I read this the other day. Excessive conduct augurs disappointment. One must not borrow a long white beard and tie it on, and threaten with the scythe of time the casually curious. One detects creative power by its capacity to conquer one's detachment. It flies along in a straight line like electricity, depopulating areas that boast of their remoteness. It proves to the high priest of caste that snobbishness is a stupidity, the best side out of age-old toadyism. Kissing the feet of the man above and kicking the face of the man below. It teaches patron saints to atheists, Colosseum, meet me alone by moonlight, maudlin troubadours, that indecorums are not life, nor yet appropriate to death. It is one thing to change one's mind, another to eradicate it. One keeps on knowing that the Negro is not brutal, the Jew is not greedy, the Oriental is not immoral, and the German is not a Hun. Now, Mrs. Witt Diamond thought I should read my schoolroom piece at Harvard summer school last year. Someone came up to me and said, I'm working on chemistry. I'm not studying poetry, but I do read some. I don't understand yours, but I understand what I like what I do understand. And I was very grateful for this open-mindedness. And so I said, what is your name? Oh, that doesn't matter. That's all right. And so one evening later, in Alstonborough Hall, this young man came in, sitting in the front row, and then handed me a paper. And he wrote a very... really very fine little poem on about social democracy, about being getting what you could out of other people. Well, this is it. Well, it's a great compliment to be got something out of by people whose will is good. And this was about the school. Oh, Philip Robb had a very fine address, and among other things, he told on what were the tests for accepting work for partisan review. And he said, well, We produce values in the process of living. A work of art must be appraised on its own ground, and our tests are maturity, plausibility, relevance of the point of view expressed. You can't solve in abstract fashion the approach between literature and politics. Values in use. I attended school and I liked the place. Grass and little locust leaf shadows like lace. Writing was discussed. They said, we create values in the process of living. Daren't await their historic progress. Be abstract and your wish had been specific. It's a fact. Now, the proof is in the pudding. The pudding is in the proof. What was I studying? Values in use. Judged on their own ground. Am I still abstruse? Walking along, a student said, offhand, now relevant and plausible were words I understand. A pleasing statement, my anonymous friend, certainly the means must not defeat the end. Now, I think I should read What Are Years? Some of these, I've been reading this, but I think it is one of my better ones. Then I'll read Silence, and then Mr. Shore thought I might read one or two fables. What are years? What is our innocence? What is our guilt? All are naked, none is safe. And whence is courage? The unanswered question, the resolute doubt, dumbly calling, deafly listening, that in misfortune even death encourages others, and in its defeat stirs the soul to be strong. He sees deep and is glad who accedes to mortality, and in his imprisonment rises upon himself as the sea in a chasm, struggling to be free and unable to be, in its surrendering finds its continuing. So he who strongly feels behaves, the very bird grown taller as he sings, steals his form straight up. Though he is captive, his mighty singing says, satisfaction is a lowly thing, a lowly thing. How pure a thing is joy. This is mortality, this is eternity. Thank you. Silence. My father used to say, superior people never make long visits. Have to be shown Longfellow's grave or the glass flowers at Harvard. So, self-reliant like the cat that takes its prey to privacy, they sometimes enjoy solitude and can be robbed of speech by speech that has delighted them. The deepest feeling always shows itself in silence. Not in silence, in restraint. Nor was he insincere in saying, make my house your inn. Inns are not residences. Well, I thank you very much for seeing something in these. The pot of clay. This doesn't compliment our judgment too much, but it is certainly a marvel the way it is put together in the French. I feel a little easier to hear that my friend Clifford Bissell is not here, And Dr. Walpole, I hope nobody else is too initiate. This is, I tried in these fables to get a similar pattern, the same pattern of tones that there is in the French. The pot of clay and the pot of iron. A pot of iron's refusal. Oh, may I ask, can you really hear now? Can everybody? A pot of iron's proposal that a clay pot fare afield met with a prompt refusal. Any joy that journeys yield is afforded by our warm hearth. Brittle pots of breakable earth are inured to sacrifice, since jostles are far from wise. I might be crushed by a blow, but don't feel that you should not go, since iron is accustomed to strain, no reason why you should remain. The other turned arguer and said, as for shocks you'd incur, or objects you saw to fear, if you felt that you'd come too near, I'd expose myself instead, and you'd not be buffeted. The clay pot was satisfied, so they fared forth, side by side, the iron and the clay one protected, each on three legs as pots are constructed. Clipper, clap, clip, they tried their luck, and then at each jolt conflicted, and if even pebbles were struck, the clay pot suffered. In less than 50 paces, the worst that could befall, left by the iron pot in fragments so minute you could not count them all, and with only himself to blame. Take as an equal a person who is not, and your fate may be the same as that of the iron pot, of the earthen pot. Now, the turkeys. The moral of this is, beg for trouble and it will come. Baiting, teasing a fox who would spring in air, some turkeys had perched in a tree, their citadel. The furred foe was trotting up near and circling far, scanning each feathered sentinel, then snarled, how now? I set at naught by turkey cocks, shallow gobblers, defy an experienced fox? Never, by all the gods, no. And caught them, as will appear. The moon glared so white that his every move was clear, the birds could see as plainly as if it were noon. Yet he was used to vigils despite a brilliant moon, with tricks in his bag for any plight. His forepaws trod air as he made his body light. He'd feign that death had cut him short. Then in a flash would rise, harlequin in each new disguise, was not so varied a multitude. He'd willow out his tail like flame that sinks and flies. His effort knew no interlude. He did so well that not a turkey could close its eyes. As he trotted to and fro, each over-weary bird would stare till its scared eyes blurred. The poor things held to the perch so dizzily that one by one the flock fell. Each was born from the tree to Master Fox's lair. He took nearly half of them home. Indeed, had endless turkeys for his use. Defeat is a thing which constant fear can induce. Beg for trouble, and it will come. Thank you. These are quite moral. Here's another. Bernard DeVoto said there's just no point in it. Morals, we're through with morals. You can't preach in verse. Well, you seem to be very kind in your feeling about these things. They said that La Fontaine refused to to write morals, and then when he started to do it, he couldn't do it enough. The head and tail of the serpent. A serpent has mobility, which can shatter intrepidity. The tail tips mental to and fro, and tail-like taper heads quick blow, like fates have the power to appall. Each had thought for years that it had no equal, and that it alone knew what to do. From the first, the head had guided the tail day by day, till the tail accused God of folly and begged mercy, saying, "I've trailed mile for mile in this way too subserviently. Was I meant to submit continually? I be but a servant, though providentially a sister, so not subservient. Twins from inception, each is each's counterpart, with the scorpion's power to hurt, each injects lethal poison." Thinking of a scorpion. "Revoke the spell I cannot break, till the head, tell the head you would rather the tail took us further, and it regulate the snake. I shall manifest a restraint that can give no cause for complaint. Now, granting fools' prayers can but presage ill, involving harm not within the giver's intent. One must be deaf to destructive argument. But this time God heard. Then, as new beetles will, our purblind tail could admire as much as baked bread saw of fire. Struck a statue in due course, a boot, some bark, deaf to remorse, fell right into the Styx and drowned her sister. Tragic rulers hastening toward a like disaster." Malcolm Cowley, editor, looked over these fables, and we had many an argument about whether the undesirable animals were male or female. I had these snakes, male snakes. But no. And the foolish dove. Foolish dove was a male dove. And no. He said, "Don't you see?" and so on. So I had both ways. Now, I'll read one more. Well, I think this cat and mouse. I think it's very hard to write a piece of verse, first of all, to please a king, and then, or a potentate, and then to have it in mind all through. I have to keep to this pattern, and I think he did this remarkably. It was for His Grace the Duke of Burgundy, who asked for one on this theme, a fable, to be called The Cat and Mouse. "Desiring to show a young prince her esteem, and bow here literarily, fame asks that cat and mouse be my theme. Cat and mouse, let me see. Ought I to portray someone beautiful and charming, but so sportive and unmerciful that she tortures the person in captivity, as cats treat mice they will not free? Or should I take as my theme the whims of fate, nothing more to the point than demonstrate how smiling fortune treats folk contradictorily, as cats treat mice they will not free? Or should some king, a great one, be my simile, at whose word even fortune's wheel stands still, undeterred by all sorts of hostility, who makes sport of the mightiest if he will, as cats toss mice they will not free? But the windings of my thought have imperceptibly brought me out where each step I take will be a loss if I let myself drone on suicidally and make my muse a mouse for the young prince to toss, like one the cat pretends to free.
Maura is kind enough to read one more poem. She'll read nevertheless.
I'm so skeptical, I didn't recognize an encore when I heard one. Thank you. I wouldn't do this to you myself, you know. I've been captive audience many and many a time. Nevertheless, you've seen a strawberry that, well, I'd like to commend at least my adaptability. This has been in print for some time, and Malvina Hoffman asked me to read some things at a woman's club in Bar Harbor, and I was reading this, and she said, well, let me hear it. What is this? And then she said, well, you say where the fragments met. Don't you mean where the segments met? Well, I said, I guess I do. So, I'll try to get it right. You've seen a strawberry that's had a struggle. Yet was, where the segments met, a hedgehog or a starfish for the multitude of seeds. What better food than apple seeds, the fruit within the fruit, locked in like counter-curved twin hazelnuts. Once, where there was a prickly pear leaf clinging to barbed wire, a root shot down to grow in earth 2 feet below. Victory won't come to me unless I go to it. A grape tendril ties a knot in knots till knotted 30 times. So the bound twig that's undergone and overgone can't stir. The weak overcomes its menace. The strong overcomes itself. What is there like fortitude? What sap went through that little thread to make the cherry red? Thank you very much.